This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Education as a Force for Social Change. Part 1, Part 1 is entitled Education as a Social Force, Lecture 1 from Dornach, August 9th, 1919. I have just completed a series of lectures and discussions that gave me deep insight into people's current feelings and the tragedy of modern society. Once again, I can return here to Dornach for a few days to a place so closely connected with the activity we believe can provide the strength to eventually turn the present tragic path of human affairs in a more positive direction. Perhaps in no other period has there been less inclination to raise people's souls to the spiritual worlds, in the truest sense, than there is today. Nonetheless, it is especially necessary to do that now. The strength people need to proceed along the path of human development can come only from the spiritual worlds. A wide range of people believe we can solve the problems presently confronting us through thoughts and ideas arising from a material perspective. It is difficult to say how long it will be before enough people become convinced that only upon the spiritual path can we find a real solution. Thinking about this question is not very fruitful, but it is certainly clear that we can move forward only when enough people become convinced that the solution to those problems comes only from the spiritual world. Modern people are greatly concerned with social questions, but they are ill-equipped to think about them, because the intellectual capacities of a large part of society are practically paralyzed. Most people believe we can overcome the present social problems with our current knowledge and understanding. We will not overcome them. We cannot overcome them if we do not tackle them from a spiritual point of view. We have just gone through a long war. A prolonged struggle will probably continue. Many people say that the war we have experienced is the most terrible event since the beginning of recorded history. We cannot claim this conclusion is false. However, the ensuing battle I refer to will be a war between East and West, between Asia, Europe, and America. It will, in all likelihood, be the greatest spiritual battle humanity will ever undertake. Everything that Christian inspiration and determination have brought to humanity will crash down onto civilization as great primal waves of destruction. Today we can state the great divergence between East and West in a simple formula. But that formula is not so simple as it appears. It encompasses a tremendous expanse of human views. You will recall that in my book titled Towards Social Renewal, I drew attention to the fact that for a large segment of modern humanity, spiritual life is only an ideology. They see everything contained in modern civilization, law, ethics, science, art, religion, and so forth, as nothing more than a wisp of smoke rising above the one and only true reality of economics and material production. I spoke of this when I was here several months ago. Ideology. That is the response you receive from many modern people when you speak of spiritual life. In truth, though, ideology is everything mirrored in human souls of, quote, the one and only reality, unquote, economic reality. There are many reasons we should think about the modern meaning of the word ideology. It means a great deal. We cannot make a closer connection between that word and any other than its connection to the word from Oriental wisdom, Maya. Maya, illusion, translated properly for Western understanding, means ideology. Every other translation is less exact. Thus, a large number of Westerners express the same basic concept or idea with the word ideology that an Oriental expresses with the word Maya. But what a tremendous difference. What does the Oriental think of as Maya? The Oriental thinks everything in the sense-perceptible world is Maya. Everything perceived by our senses and all thinking connected with sense perceptions is Maya, the great illusion. The only reality is the reality of the soul. What a human being achieves in his or her soul is reality. What arises and blossoms in inner life is reality. What presents itself to the senses is Maya, illusion, ideology. Conversely, a large number of Westerners are convinced that the only reality is the reality perceptible to the normal senses. For them, reality is exactly what the Oriental calls Maya. On the other hand, Oriental reality, namely what arises and blossoms in the soul, is for a large part of Occidentals only Maya, ideology. You can see the discrepancy. Oriental reality is called ideology in Europe and America, and Western ideology is called reality in the Orient. Those viewpoints eat into people's souls and form two distinct kinds of beings. If you look at recent events in the civilized world, you will recognize that everything said about the causes and motives of the world catastrophe is simply superficial. The primal forces characterizing that terrible battle arose from the unconscious depths of the human soul. Today we can see that people do not even know why they took part in it. The reason lies in the elemental forces brought to the surface by divergent views that are far from being resolved. The present antisocial force is so strong that humanity is now divided into two essentially different kinds of people. If you consider all I have said in this regard when you look toward the West, you will see an aspiration toward freedom. Whether people there fully understand freedom is not so important. The tendency is toward freedom. The desire for freedom stirs in the dark recesses of the human soul. Now look toward the East. Everything the West calls freedom has no real meaning in the East. There, people have no comprehension of freedom. They cannot connect any feelings with it. People think the least about those things they experience most intensely. Just think how little attention they give to everyday natural occurrences. People do not think about their most immediate experiences. The Oriental, living in the view of reality prevalent there, namely inner reality, lives in freedom to the extent possible within his or her racial, national, or tribal context. The Oriental gives no thought to this. However, the more westward we look, the more we see that freedom has been lost in the course of historical human development. There, people long for freedom because they do not have it. I could give many more examples of the fundamentally different views of East and West. There are already some indications of what the next few years may bring. The modern events in Asia that are kept secret in Europe for well-known reasons are simply symptoms. The spiritual perspective of the Indian people gives them a very different picture of the fact that half the population is starving from the one that arises here in Europe under similar external circumstances. Humanity is divided into two essentially different groups, even regarding such external events. Hunger means something quite different for the Indian than it does for a European, because Europeans and Indians have thousands of years of different soul development behind them. People who want to understand the course of human development must look closely at such things. We need to be aware that the problems facing society are much more complicated than people commonly believe. Today's social problems are simply a side effect of the cultural development that began in the mid-15th century. I have often mentioned the important turning point in human history that occurred in the mid-15th century when the modern coloring of science and industrialism began. Modern science and industrialism are the expressions of the forces that entered human development and gave modern human spiritual development its particular direction. I have often spoken about the nature of science and about how intelligent people view it. People who think about science realize it does not give a true picture of the world, but only a shadow of it. Everything that scientists have thought up and that people consider common knowledge, more common than many believe, is a belief, or more properly a superstition, about a phantom world. Then this combines with the spiritual effects of modern industrialism. However, we should look more closely at the spiritual significance of industrialism. Take, for example, that embodiment of industrialism, the machine. Machines differ from everything else people encounter in normal life, such as animals. You can apply all your scientific or other thoughts to an animal. I do not want to even begin talking about human beings in this respect. And regardless of how much you imagine it, it still retains an aspect of something we might call a, quote, creature of God. You can never completely discover the essence of an animal. There is always something hidden in the idea of an animal. That is not less the case for plants or even crystals. If you take all the wonderful crystal forms, you have to admit that even though with some training you can comprehend crystal forms and so forth, there are still many aspects of crystals you can look at in awe and cannot comprehend simply with conventional intellect. But now look at a machine. It is perfectly transparent. You know everything about it. We apply power here, the bearings are here and there, the amount of friction is so and so much. Thus you can calculate its efficiency, if you know all the factors involved. There is nothing about a machine we cannot understand with normal intelligence and reasoning. However, that is significant for the relationship of humans to machines. If you have met thousands and thousands of people who work with machines, then you will have learned what the souls of such people have slowly absorbed. You will see, or perhaps only sense, what has crept into people's souls from these spiritually transparent machines. What makes machines so devastating for people is their spiritual transparency. All the forces and interactions in machines are so clear and transparent to the human mind. Mechanical clarity draws life out of the human heart and soul, makes people dry and inhuman. The combination of science and machines threatens civilization with three forms of destruction if we do not pull ourselves together enough to look toward the supersensible. The scientific ideal, namely to model everything after the astronomical picture, is slowly gaining the upper hand. The ideal for many people is to model all our understanding of nature after the astronomer's model of the universe. Think about how chemists picture molecules. They imagine molecules as composed of atoms connected to one another by certain forces, so that the result is like small planetary systems. The ideal is to explain the whole world astronomically, but the goal of astronomy is to view the structure of the universe as a machine. Add to that all the work people do with machines. Those are the things that have had an increasingly strong effect since the mid-15th century and are now robbing human beings of their humanity. If people carry the thinking of mechanistic astronomy and industry into the remainder of life, then their spirits will become mechanized, their souls sleepy and vegetized, and their bodies animalized. Look at America, the epitome of mechanized spirit. Look to the eastern part of Europe and Russia. The urges and instincts roaming wild there are terrible, and they result in the animalization of the body. In the middle, in Europe, we find sleepiness in the soul. Mechanization of the spirit, vegetation of the soul, animalization of the body. That is what we must face without delusion. The way we lost the third element of life, along with the other two, is characteristic of the path of human development since the mid-15th century. a powerful modern political party, calls itself the Social Democrats, thus welding socialism and democracy together, although they are the opposites of each other. They are welded together, but the spiritual was left out because socialism relates only to the economic realm, and democracy relates only to the rights realm, while the spiritual relates to individualism. The name social democracy omits freedom. Otherwise it would be called individual or individualized social democracy. In that case, we would express all three human desires in one such slogan. It is characteristic of modern times that we omit this third aspect, and that the spirit, in a certain sense, really becomes Maya, the great illusion of civilized Western humanity, that is, of Europe and its colonial descendants in America. This is where we must begin when we consider spiritual science as a major cultural question. Actually, we cannot even discuss current demands, since they are historical demands. Socialism is an historical demand, and we can properly understand it only in that sense. Democracy is an historical demand. However, liberalism, freedom, individualism are also historical demands, but modern people seldom notice them as such. It is not possible to discuss the situation further unless we recognize the social organism in its three aspects: socialism in economic life, democracy in the life of rights, and freedom or individuality in cultural life. That is, in truth, the only salvation for humanity. Although those are the intense and unyielding historical tendencies of the present, we should not delude ourselves into thinking that no other demands will appear to those who have a deep insight into the situation. Adults need to live in a society that is economically, social, governmentally democratic, and culturally free. The main question for the future is how we will conduct ourselves with children if we want to raise them to be, in the broadest sense of the words, social, democratic, and free adults. One of the most important problems for the future, a problem already confronting us, is the question of education. Anthroposophy has already pointed to how we should understand education at the present time if we want to move forward. The demands of society will remain chaotic if we do not see that the result for this chaos lies in the urgent question of contemporary education. If you are interested in the general outline of the education question, you need only look at my book titled The Education of the Child in the Light of Anthroposophy. There, I have brought one of the most important problems in modern society to the surface, namely social education. An understanding of the three periods of child development as presented by spiritual science needs to be more widespread. You know that in the period between birth and the age of 7, which concludes with the change of teeth, human beings are imitative, that is, they do what they observe in their surroundings. If you look at young children with some understanding, you will always find that they are imitative and do what quote-unquote, big people do. For young children, it is extremely important that the people around them do only what they should imitate. It is important that you think and feel only what children should imitate when you are in their presence. Children carry their prenatal experiences in the spiritual world into physical existence after birth. In the spiritual world, we human beings live in the beings of the higher hierarchies. Everything we do arises out of the nature of the higher hierarchies. There we are imitative to a much greater extent, because we are united with those beings we imitate. Then we are placed into the physical world, but we continue our habit of being at one with our surroundings. The habit of being at one with the beings in our surroundings, of imitating them, continues. We continue to imitate those who are responsible for our upbringing and who are to do and feel only what we should imitate. It is extremely healthy for children to be able to live not so much in their own souls, but in the souls of the people around them. In the past, people could rely upon the instinct to imitate, because their lives were more instinctive. But in the future, this will no longer be possible. In the future, we must attend to the fact that the child's behavior is imitative. In raising children, we need to continuously keep in mind how we can best create the most favorable environment for their imitative behavior. Everything done in the past regarding imitation must become more and more conscious and more consciously connected with the future. People will need to remind themselves that if children are to grow up to meet the needs of the social organism, they must be free. People become free only if they were intensely imitative as children. We need to intensely develop the strength, the natural strength of children, in preparation for that time when they begin to become socially interactive. In spite of all political complaining about freedom, and in spite of all the other talk, people will become free only if we ingrain the strength of imitation in them during childhood. Only what we thus implant during childhood can serve as a basis for social freedom. You also know that from the age of 7 until puberty, that is, until the age of 14 or 15, children have a strength we could call, quote, acting upon authority, unquote. Children experience a great uplifting if they can do everything because a person they look up to says it is the right thing to do. There is nothing worse for children than attempting to develop their judgment too early, before puberty. Children's sense of authority will need to be more intensively and more highly developed between the ages of 7 and 14 in the future than it was in the past. We must, with increasing consciousness, direct all upbringing and education during these years toward awakening in children a pure and beautiful feeling toward authority. What we implant during these years will form the basis for what adults within the social organism experience as equal rights for their fellow human beings. A feeling for equal rights for other human beings cannot exist in adults if a feeling for authority is not implanted in them during childhood. Otherwise, adults will never become mature enough to recognize the rights of others. It may well be that in the past, a much lesser degree of feeling for authority was sufficient. However, in the future, that will no longer suffice. We must strongly implant in children this feeling toward authority, so that, as adults, they will become mature enough for what arises as an historical demand and is not open to argument. We should arrange everything in elementary education so that children achieve that perspective during this stage of development. Now, I ask you not only how far modern people are from an insight into such things, but also how far is modern teacher training from such insight? How must we work to make that insight known? It must become known because only through it can we find healing. If you travel today to countries where the first revolution has already occurred, what do you find in their policies for so-called unified schools? What are their policies actually? For those who have insight into the connections within human nature, the socialist educational policies are truly shocking. They are the worst imaginable. The worst possible things you could think of are the schools and lesson plans and school organization connected with Lunacharsky, the Minister of Education in Russia. What is playing out in Russia as an educational policy is the death of all real social thinking. There are also socialist educational policies in other parts of Europe that are truly cancerous because they are based upon an absolutely unbelievable idea, the idea that we should organize schools in approximately the same way that adults should live within society. I have read such policies whose first statement is that we should eliminate the principal's office, that teachers and students should be absolutely equal, and that we should base the entire school upon an attitude of comradeship. If you say anything against such ideas, for instance in southern Germany, where things have progressed much less than in other areas of Europe, then you are looked upon as someone who has absolutely no understanding of social life. However, those who have honest intentions regarding the progress of humanity toward a truly social society must be clear that such a society can never develop through socialist educational programs. If we introduce socialism in the schools, a social attitude cannot exist in life. People can mature enough for socially responsible community life only if they learn to build their lives upon that true authority they experience during their school years. Today we must make it clear how far people's actions and imagined needs are from what we should be doing and what truly relates to reality. After puberty, from the age of 14 to 21, more than sexually oriented love develops in people. That form of love is only a special form of a general love of humanity. The strength that arises from a general love of humanity needs particular care at the time when children leave elementary school and go on either to higher education or into an apprenticeship. The feeling of fraternity, that is, a general love of humanity, can never warm the relationships in economic life, as history requires, if we do not develop a love of humanity during these years. The kind of fraternity we must strive for in future economic life can exist in human souls only if we form education after the age of 15, so that we work completely consciously toward a general love of humanity. And only when all questions regarding world views and all education following the unified school are based upon a love of humanity, or more generally speaking, a love of the external world. We must base what should bloom within future humanity upon these three aspects of education. If we do not recognize that the physical aspect of the human being is imitative and needs to imitate proper things, we will only implant animalistic urges into the human physical body. If we do not recognize that from the age of 7 until 14, the etheric aspect of the human being needs particular care and must be developed upon authority, then we will only develop a cultural sleepiness in human beings, and the strength necessary for justice will not exist. If we do not recognize that beginning at the age of 14 or 15, we need to bring the power of love connected with the astral body into all teaching in a reasonable way, then children will never develop their astral bodies because they will be unable to form them into a free aspect of human nature. These things are completely interwoven, and thus I must say, imitation in the proper manner develops freedom, authority, justice, and fraternity or love, economic life. However, the reverse is also true. If we do not develop love in the proper manner, freedom is missing. And if we do not develop imitation properly, then animalistic urges prevail. When you look at the problem and consider the major historical trends, you can see that spiritual science is the proper foundation for our present goals and for the future content of culture. Without the proper cultural content, which we can derive only from spiritual science, humanity will not be able to truly develop further. Therefore, we must bring the problems before us into a spiritual context, and that must become the conviction lying within human souls. I need to emphasize again that we can discuss how long it will take for such a conviction to permeate people's souls, but it is clear that people cannot reach what they strive toward unconsciously without this conviction. From this, I believe you can see the connection between our work in the specific areas of spiritual science and what has resulted from modern needs, from great historical trends and human necessities for the present and near future. That is also why I have often said that we need to consider spiritual science in connection with great modern tasks. Today, though, people are very, very far from being able to judge things in the way I have characterized them. People need a kind of stress, a kind of dissatisfaction to counter their purely material tendency and motivate them to change direction toward spirituality. Otherwise, how will people find their way toward understanding the great question of our time, along a path contrary to the path prepared by Maya and ideology? What has actually happened? The impulses that arise in human souls from Eastern or Western thinking are quite different when seen concretely. There is, however, something curious about this, namely, that these impulses create the same mood of soul in both East and West. We would do well to look at this mood more closely. The Oriental view that the external world is Maya is old. It was an important mystical understanding of the world in earlier times, but it is no longer true. A kind of passive subjugation has entered this Oriental view precisely because it is outdated. This fatalistic attitude spilled over into Europe in the crassest manner through the Turkish culture. Fatalism, let happen what will, means passivity of the human will. The Western view of Maya exists in the way the West lives, in an atmosphere of fatalism. Marx and Engels, whose view is the modern socialist principle, most precisely expressed that viewpoint of ideology, a viewpoint in which everything connected with the spirit and soul, which is Maya, an illusion, arises only from the one single reality, namely the economic process. How did this appear in the world? Fatalistically. Until the catastrophe of the World War, what was the external expression of the socialist principle? It was the concentration of capital. Larger and larger capitalists or capitalistic groups formed, trusts, monopolies, and so forth. The economic process progresses through its own momentum. Capital concentrates more and more in the hands of capitalist groups, until the time arrives where the ownership of capital goes to the proletariat of its own accord. People need to do nothing at all, because it is an objective, purely economic process, thus fatalistic. The Orient arrived at a point of fatalism, but the Occident began there, at least for a majority of the population. The majority of the population is fatalistic. The principle of the East became one of allowing everything that occurs in the world to happen to you, but that is the starting principle in the West. Fatalistically allowing everything to occur is a cultural principle in the East, but in the West it is a material economic process. People everywhere look at the development of human society one-sidedly. If you have an overview of current developments in human society and how they arose from earlier situations, you will find a spiritual element that has become ideology. What is its basis? It is based upon Greek culture. The deepest tendency in the makeup of our souls contains something that is fundamentally Greek. This is why we have the classical preparatory schools, gymnasien, that are an educational imitation of the Greek soul. In ancient Greece, it was natural for people nearing puberty to be so disposed, because the ancient Greek culture developed in such a way that the majority of people were either helots or slaves. Their conquerors were of a different bloodline, and were the bearers of spiritual life, the rightful bearers of spiritual life. Greek sculpture expresses that particularly well. Look at the bust of Mercury with his ears, eyes, and nose placed quite differently. I have often mentioned this. Through the characteristics the Greeks sculpted into Mercury, they hinted at the people they had conquered, at those people to whom they left commerce. The Arian, characterized in busts of Zeus or Hera or Athena, was the one upon whom cosmic powers bestowed the spirit. You should not believe that what manifested as the Greeks' soul structure expressed itself only in their general soul constitution. The way words are formed in the Greek language, a language based upon a socially aristocratic soul, also expresses it. We still have this in our culture, which means that we did not experience a renewal of culture in the mid-15th century, but only a renaissance or a reformation, a kind of refreshing of our cultural life. This all still exists in our own culture. We teach the students in our classical schools in a manner foreign to life. It was natural to teach youth in ancient Greece the way that our youth are taught in classical schools, because that was the Greek life. The Greeks raised their children and youth according to their own way of life, but we raise our youth according to the way of Greek life. For this reason, our cultural life has become unreal, foreign, and is perceived as an ideology. Our culture is incapable of understanding life and incapable of grappling with and being active in life. In addition to these cultural aspects, we have also undergone a remarkable development regarding rights. We can find the major change in human development that occurred in the mid-15th century in all areas of life. Grain and everything made from grain is too expensive today. It is overpriced. If you search for the time when it was too cheap in Europe, you find that this was in about the 9th or 10th century. Then it was just as much too cheap as it is today too expensive, and in the mid-15th century, it had a fair price. It is interesting to see how the major change that occurred in the mid-15th century played right into the price of grain. What happened when grain prices were fair for the greater part of Europe? In about the middle of the 15th century, serfdom began to disappear. Then Roman law forced its way in to destroy the beginnings of freedom. Just as the Greek spirit and soul permeates us, the Roman concept of law also permeates our politics and government. Until now, we have been unable to create anything more in the area of rights than a renaissance of Roman law. In our social organism, we have Greek cultural forms and Roman state structures. In economics, a renaissance is not possible. Of course, we can live according to Roman law and educate children according to the Greek spirit, but we cannot eat what the Greeks ate, because we would never satisfy our hunger. Economic life must exist in the present. Thus, we have European economic life as the third element. We must create order in these three chaotically mixed areas, and we can do this only through the threefold social organism. People like Marx and Engels saw things very one-sidedly when they recognized we can no longer model our society after the Greek ideal and can no longer govern according to Roman law. They concluded that the only thing remaining is economics. But they considered only economics. As Engels says, we may only administer commodities and guide production processes. We may no longer govern human beings. This is just as one-sided as it is correct. Correct, but terribly one-sided. We must set economic life upon its own basis. Within the economy of the social organism, we must administer commodities and guide production processes that must become independent. However, if we remove the former basis of rights and culture from the social organism, then we must establish a new foundation. That means that alongside economic life, which administers commodities and guides production processes, we need a democratic government based upon equality among human beings. We do not need just a renaissance of Roman law. We need a new birth of the state based upon the equality of human beings. We do not need just a renaissance of culture as occurred at the beginning of the modern era. We need a new formation, a new creation of culture. We must become aware that we are standing before the task of recreating cultural life. There is a connection between what lives deep in the development of modern humanity and what the threefold social organism expresses. It is not a sudden idea, but something born out of the deepest needs of our times, something particularly appropriate to the present. There are people, many people, who say they do not understand that. It is too difficult. In Germany, when people repeated how difficult this is to understand, I told them that these things are to be understood differently than people have become accustomed to understanding things in the last 4 or 5 years. During that time, people found it easy to understand things I did not understand, since they only needed someone to order them to understand. All people needed was an order from headquarters, or some other authority, and they understood things because they were ordered to understand them. People even framed these orders. Now, however, it is important that we understand things with a free human soul. But to do this, our souls must awaken, something they have little desire to do. But that is what is important. It is not that things are difficult to understand, it is that we lack the will and courage to look at reality. It is quite natural that we must say those things we need to say to humanity in a new tone, in sentences different from those to which people have become accustomed. It is natural because we are caught up in three things quite different from those spoken of in the threefold social organism. There, a renewal of cultural life is necessary for people to really perceive the connection of their souls with objective spiritual life. People do not have that now. When people speak today, to a large extent they speak in slogans. But why do they speak in slogans? That can only be because they have no connection with the meaning of those slogans. People no longer have a connection with spiritual life, so their words have become slogans. Much has been said in recent years about maintaining human rights, at least in the civilized world. Events of the present provide sufficient evidence about how far people are from reality concerning rights. People have spoken about rights, but they actually have no concern for justice, only for power. Likewise, people have not had thoughts capable of encompassing economics, and therefore it has gotten out of control. Economics has been characterized simply as more and more production. That is what I said in Vienna in the spring of 1914, when I remarked that this continuous production is a cancer in society. More and more was produced, the products were thrown onto the market, and the whole economic cycle continued on by itself without any thoughtful control. Chaotic, unplanned economics. Rights that are only a struggle for power. Culture debased to slogans. These are the three basic aspects of our present-day society. We must escape from them. But we can escape only if we earnestly try to understand the intent of the threefold social organism. As you can see, this relates to an understanding possible only through spiritual science. Something I said a few weeks ago in a public lecture resulted in much consternation. However, it is a basic and factual point. Then I said that our present leaders may no longer rely upon their brains, which have become decadent. They must rise to a comprehension of things that no longer requires the brain, but instead uses the etheric body. The thoughts brought together in anthroposophy do not require the brain. Because of their physiological development, our leaders and members of the modern bourgeois class must accustom themselves to acquiescing on matters of spiritual knowledge, while taking care of what can be taken care of with decadent brains. The proletariat still have fresh brains and move forward. The lemon is not yet squeezed dry. An atavistic characteristic of the brain still exists. That is why the proletariat understand what is said today about a new social structure. The situation today is such that essentially all the proletariat, except their leaders, are open to these things. Their leaders have become middle class. They have become the most narrow-minded of all. They have taken over the realm of middle class narrow-mindedness and developed it to a high degree. On the other hand, though, within the proletariat there exists a terrible penchant for obedience, and this submissiveness must be broken before there can be any improvement. Things are now more complicated than people usually think. Essentially, only the science of initiation can provide the means that lead to a correct understanding of modern social problems. In my book titled Towards Social Renewal, which I wrote not only for anthroposophists but for the general public, you will find three important concepts mentioned concerning modern social life. The first is the economic concept of commodity or products. Another important concept is that of labor. And the third is the concept of capital. An understanding of the modern social situation depends upon these three concepts. Think of everything social science has said to explain these three concepts. If you know what was said in economics in the second half of the 19th century to explain the concepts of commodity, labor, and capital, then you are aware of all the useless scientific work that resulted from an incomplete science of economics. I recently mentioned the examples of the famous professor Lujo Brentano, a leading modern economist in Middle Europe, who recently wrote an article entitled The Industrialist. In it, he develops three characteristics of an industrialist. I will mention only Brentano's third characteristic, namely that industrialists use the means of production at their own cost and risk. It's true, isn't it? Industrialists own the means of production and undertake market production at their own cost and risk. Now, the concept as formulated by Brentano, that leading light of modern academic economics, is such that in the same article he deduces whom, along with an industrialist, we may also call an entrepreneur, namely the worker. The modern worker is also an entrepreneur because he also has means of production, namely his ability to work, and offers these on the market at his own cost and risk. Brentano's concept of an entrepreneur is so clear that workers also fall into this category. You can see how clever modern economists are. The situation is ridiculous. But today we are unable to laugh about this because the universities have the position of leadership in cultural life. However, universities produce this sort of thing in the field of economics. People will not admit, nor do they have the courage to admit, that such ridiculous work is produced. Things are simply terrible. We absolutely must look at these things and ask, how is it possible, particularly concerning the burning questions of the day, that science cannot shed light on these social concepts? I would very much like to discuss this question with you during my visit here, but today I can only touch upon why this is so. As simple as the economic concept of commodity is, you can never fully understand it by normal science. You can never completely understand the concept of commodity if you do not begin with an imaginative understanding. You cannot comprehend the concept of labor, socially or economically, if you do not base your understanding in inspiration. You cannot define capital if you do not bring in intuitive understanding. The concept of commodities requires imagination. The concept of labor requires inspiration. The concept of capital requires intuition. If these concepts are not formulated in this way, only confusion results. You can see why only confusion results if you look at a particular case. Why does Brentano so closely connect the concept of capital with the concept of entrepreneur that the worker then becomes a capitalist or entrepreneur? He is, of course, a very wise man of the times, but he has absolutely no idea how to use intuitive cognition to obtain a true concept of capital. Of course, this all comes about indirectly. The Bible gives some indication of this path when it speaks of capitalism as mammonism, and thus connects capital to a particular kind of spirituality. However, we can only understand spirituality through intuition. And if we want to understand the spirituality active in capitalism, namely mammonism, we need intuition. That is what the Bible contains. But today we need an understanding of the world appropriate to modern times. We must attempt to understand objectively these things we hold to be somewhat twisted today. Genuinely objective knowledge in these areas will show the necessity of permeating social viewpoints everywhere with true spiritual science. This is what unprejudiced modern observers of life must impress upon themselves. Perhaps you recall a question posed to me some time ago following a lecture in Basel. During the discussion, someone asked how we could make Lenin ruler of the world. According to that person, the world situation would not improve until Lenin became the ruler of the world. Imagine the kind of confusion this indicates. What this means is that those people who present themselves as the most radical are, in actuality, the most reactionary. They want socialism, but we need to begin by socializing the ruling relationships. However, those people begin socialization with a universal economic monarchy led by Lenin. They do not even begin to socialize the relationships between the governed and the governing. That is how grotesque things are today. It is certainly something to think about when you are told that Lenin should become king of the world. But that is how things are today. Those who believe they have the most progressive concepts have in actuality the most twisted ones. People will not come to any clarity in this area if they cannot admit that we must seek such clarity through spiritual science. The end of lecture one. The end of lecture one.